This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Make the solutions cheap, or at least put them on a path of getting cheaper all the time, and the world will believe more that it's possible, and the world will sign up for more stringent targets, and the world will just start deploying more clean technology when it's cost competitive in their areas.
If you've been wondering what people mean when they talk about a Green New Deal, today's episode of Sea Change Radio should help. This week, we air the second half of our discussion with technologist Ramez Naam. Last week, Naam shared some of the specifics of the Green New Deal. This week, we talk about the best way to pitch any plan to the American public, whether a measure for restricting individual consumption ought to be included in the plan, and the importance of considering vulnerable populations around the globe when crafting sound climate policy. Then, with summer kicking off, we revisit our conversation with Craig Downs of the Hereticus Institute to learn about which sunscreen ingredients to avoid and which are safe for fragile marine ecosystems. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Ramez Naam. He is the co-chair of Energy and Environment at Singularity University, and he's a writer, investor, and speaker on clean energy. Ramez, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, Alex. Thanks for having me.
So a lot of people forget that the New Deal itself was an investment in infrastructure, and it paid off many times over. I've read Vox's Matthew Iglesias calling for it not being called a Green New Deal, but a Green Marshall Plan. But the Marshall Plan was more of a rescue. It was not as much of a direct investment. It was more like aid to Europe after World War II. So I think it's important to hammer home the messaging that this makes good business sense. This isn't just a big outlay. You hear people saying, how are we going to pay for this? Well, it'll pay for itself pretty quickly if done correctly, right?
That's right. In the short term, you've got to offer, between now and November 2020, when we still have a Republican president and a Republicans-led Senate, you've got to offer some stuff that some Republicans will come on board with. So they've got to see it as not too radical socially or economically. They've got to see it as pro-business, and they've got to see it as pro their constituents. And their constituents, fortunately in the Midwest, farmers, industry, wind power, so on. And in the Southwest, Arizona, pretty red state, solar there. So that's how you've got to appeal. And then to avoid the filibuster, the nice thing is that the way that the tax bills get passed is the House will pass one, the Senate will pass one, and they'll negotiate about it in reconciliation. And so there's a room to, the tax code is how we've done a lot of energy policy, actually. There's room to, in that negotiation, for the Democrats from the House to get some of what they want into the tax code this year and next year. After 2020, if there's a Democratic president and a Democratic majority in the Senate, things change a little bit. But even then, unless you are going to nuke the filibuster, you're going to have to bring some Republicans on board. And so, again, I think it's about that storytelling. For me, my fiction has always sold tremendously more than my nonfiction, because my fiction has story. Now, when I give my talks, it's a story. And the story is one of economic inevitability, of clean energy just getting so cheap that it's, for so long now, that it's clearly on a path to be what wins, of economic growth, of we don't have to sacrifice growth to solve climate change, because there's a whole lot of work to do to deploy clean energy, and clean energy is going to be cheaper than coal or gas anyway, so it's going to be an engine of growth for us. And those sorts of positive, solution-oriented stories, you get more allies in the middle and the right than bleak or radical ones. And I actually don't think that the U.S. federal government has to be putting in the capital for a lot of these projects. I think there's a unique role for U.S. federal R&D, and the tax code does mean foregoing some revenue in helping to spur industry. But frankly, the world is awash in capital. There's tons of capital out there. So if you just give industry and utilities and farmers a good reason, an economic reason, to deploy the clean technologies that we invent with federal R&D money, they'll do it, right? If you make it cheaper, the money will come to deploy it.
And this is where you differ a little bit from the Democratic plan that's being kicked around, mostly from the office originally of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, right?
Well, I mean, the Green New Deal resolution actually doesn't say how it will go about doing these things. So it talks really more about outcomes and targets than it does about mechanisms. And so most of what I've talked to you about is mechanisms, right? So I think it's actually really hard to predict, you know, what outcome you get with a certain mechanism. But mechanisms are what we pass. You can pass a law that says we must be, decarbonized X by this year. But okay, what are you actually doing? How does the law work to get people to deploy solar and wind, or to invent, carbon neutral steel and things like that?
So you are a technologist, Ramez, and you are approaching this from what some critics might look at as kind of a lot of silver bullets. You're hoping that industry can successfully come up with solutions on these many levels that need to be solved.
What we don't see from your plan is kind of a way to try and reduce excessive consumption.
I'm sure you thought of this. Is that because you don't think it's necessarily viable to ask for people to stop consuming, or is it because of that's just human nature to want to consume more? Maybe you can kind of delve into that angle if you can.
I don't think you're going to have much success in asking people to live lives that feel more constrained than they do today. You know, in World War II we did, but climate change is not like World War II. Like, you could really identify, anthropomorphize. You didn't have to anthropomorphize. There were like people that you could point to as the enemy, and it felt really urgent in a way that I don't think climate change will ever feel really urgent to the vast majority of Americans.
And for people in developing countries as well, who haven't really been able to benefit from the Industrial Revolution, and now all of a sudden they're on the cusp of some these nice amenities, and we want to say, oh, sorry, climate change is more important than your ability to, have running water.
There's 1 billion people in India, and they have a per capita energy use that is 1/10 of what an American's is, right? And so who are we to say to them, you can't rise to an American level of, standard of living, of abundance? Like, that, why would they listen to us on that? But the vast majority of new electricity generation deployed in India in this fiscal year since July 1st was solar. And that's because solar is now cheaper than coal in India. So that's the way. That's the biggest lever you have. There's another lever. If we act, and we're seen to act, we also have more power at the negotiating table then as well. So we can ask some countries to take some additional pain if they see that we're taking pain as well. But the bigger lever is make the solutions cheap, or at least put them on a path of getting cheaper all the time, and the world will believe more that it's possible, and the world will sign up for more stringent targets, and the world will just start deploying more clean technology when it's cost competitive in their areas.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to technologist Ramez Nam. And you make an important point that Americans may only emit 15% of carbon emissions today, which is still quite a bit when you consider how much of the population the United States comprises in terms of global population. But all of the CO2 we've emitted in the past, quote, will linger in the atmosphere for roughly a century from when it was released. That's something we don't think about.
Yeah. So when we measure all of the emissions that are still in the atmosphere from all the countries of the world the U.S. is number one. We are number one in terms of the being responsible for the climate change that we have caused thus far and for decades to come.
And so when somebody says, well, why should we be taking unilateral action when India or China haven't taken the same action, what do you say to those policymakers?
Well, A, the action is in our self-interest, because by acting, you know, we can get to cheaper electricity, cheaper transportation, healthier forests, fewer forest fires, better farms, all this stuff. And B, China and India are acting. China is the world's number one deployer of solar in its own country, number one deployer of wind power in its own country, number one deployer of electric vehicles. China has a national electric vehicle mandate, which we don't. They're actually more aggressive on solar, wind, and electric vehicles than the U.S. is today. And India is now in the process of switching over whole hog for their new electricity deployment anyway to solar. And Modi there, the Prime Minister of India, just made a big announcement on pushing on electric vehicles as well. So those two countries, the two largest nations on Earth, are really going pretty aggressive. And they will never have the same carbon emissions per person that the U.S. has.
And do you think that their epiphanies over the last decade plus in the clean energy space are more a function of just good investments, or that there's no climate change denial movement of any import in countries like India and China?
I mean, the Chinese Politburo are basically all engineers, and I've never heard of any, you know, climate denialism there or in India. But there's a more pressing need that's probably driving them, which is that air pollution is so bad in China and now in India, too, in cities like Mumbai and Delhi and also in Beijing and Shanghai. The air pollution is so bad that it's really hitting people's quality of life. And everyone that lives in those cities can see it. And the leaders of China and their families live in Beijing. And the richest people in China live in Beijing and Shanghai and Shenzhen. And they all live under the same smog. And so I think for the Chinese Communist Party, it's actually an existential threat, air pollution is. So they have to clean up their skies and their water and deal with some of the issues with their food supply as well, like melamine and milk and scandals like that. That's the biggest cause of unrest in China today. And in India, it's not really a driver of unrest, but, you know, the politicians live in Delhi, and Delhi has air pollution that looks like Beijing now. And so this is what happened in America in the 70s. You know, in 1969, the Cuyahoga River caught on fire in the U.S. The smog in L.A. and New York was unbearable. And the U.S. changed, and we cleaned up our air. We didn't solve climate. We didn't really know about climate all that much then, or we didn't see it. But we cleaned up our air, and it didn't stop economic growth. We kept on growing, we kept on getting richer, and getting higher quality of life and inventing things like, you know, the iPhone and whatnot. So we did it, and China and India want to do it too, and they see that they might as well just do it by going all the way to clean electricity, clean cars, electrification of transport, and clean industry.
And let's talk about carbon capture as a piece of this Green New Deal. We think of clean coal. That's kind of ruined the idea for a lot of carbon capture, when most experts agree that cleaner coal might be possible, but clean coal is definitely a misnomer. So do you think carbon capture has a future in a Green New Deal?
Capturing the carbon emissions from a coal plant or a natural gas plant is technologically possible, and sequestering it for a long time. I don't think it'll ever be economic to allow them to compete with solar and wind, because solar and wind and batteries is going to be cheaper than coal and gas, even before you add the cost of capturing carbon to coal and gas. You know, I'd support having those in a bill that also did stuff for solar and wind and batteries, just because, sure, let them take a shot at it, but I don't think it'll ever be cheap enough. That said, if you look at the 2 degrees Celsius scenario, we're probably not on path for it now without doing some carbon capture. But the cheapest way to capture carbon from the atmosphere isn't to build giant machines to suck it out of the air. It's actually to suck it into the ecosystem. So if you look, Shell just launched this program in the Netherlands. They're a, you know, part Dutch company, where for a penny a liter, about 4 cents a gallon, you can make your gas at the gas pump carbon neutral. And what they're doing is they are literally planting trees and restoring wetlands, because that takes carbon out of the atmosphere. So it's about $5 a ton, whereas big fancy machines that suck carbon out of the atmosphere might get down to like $100 a ton. So for between $5 to $30 a ton on soils, I'm an investor in a company called Nori that makes a marketplace to pay farmers to change how they farm to capture more carbon in the soil. There's other companies and technology out there to pay people to plant trees or not to deforest, to preserve or restore wetlands. Those together can capture about 11 billion tons of carbon a year, we think, if we max them out. And they have all kinds of secondary benefits, because now you've got richer soils, you've got forests that have biodiversity, you've got wetlands that protect your coastlines from erosion and host birds and so on, and they're just the cheapest. So that's, you know, I'm not that much of a hippie. I actually love super cool high-tech stuff, but that's just the cheapest way to capture carbon, and it can capture an awful lot.
Hippie.
Techno-hippie.
He's a technologist and a co-chair of energy and environment at Singularity University, Ramez Nam. Ramez, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's been great.
Now is the time for all good men to get together with one another. Out of their problems and out of their quarrels, and try to live as brothers, and try to find peace within without stepping on one another, and do respect to the women of the world. Just remember we all had mothers.
Make this land a better land and a world in which we live,
and help each man be a better man with the kindness that you give. I know we can make it. Well, we can work it out.
Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Again, we can. Wherever we want, yes, we can. Can.
I know we can make it work. I know we can make it if we try.
Oh, yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Break across your mind. Yes, we can. I know we can.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Craig Downs. Craig is the executive director of the Hereticus Environmental Laboratory. Craig, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me, Alex. I appreciate it.
So for our listeners, what is the Hereticus Environmental Laboratory? It's a great name. Maybe give us also a little bit of the background of that.
All right. We are a 501c3 nonprofit science and education organization. We do pretty much pro bono forensic investigations around the world for people and environments that can't defend themselves. So we'll look at coral reefs to wetlands that are dying. Nobody knows what they're dying from, and we'll figure out what they're dying from. And then we will work with grassroots organizations all the way up to international NGOs and governments to change the condition of that environment or population.
And where does the name Hereticus come from?
Hereticus comes from the Greek word heresy or heretic, and it originally means to, once you know something, you can choose to do something. So an oil executive that we were working with told me that if we were to begin to do pro bono cases, that we would be a heretic to the industry. And I like that concept so much that that's what we named our organization.
So you've been working on research and trying to raise awareness of the role that sunscreen is playing. Certain sunscreens are playing in killing off coral reefs. Why don't you first explain what types of sunscreens we're looking at and maybe give us kind of the beginnings of the research, if you will.
So we were tasked back in 2005, 2006 by the U.S. National Park Service to begin figuring out why certain coral reefs were dying and not recovering in one of their national parks, the Virgin Islands National Park in St. John, U.S. Virgin Islands. And one of the most famous beaches, Trunk Bay, we discovered that it was sunscreen pollution as the dominant stressor that was killing the reef and suppressing the restoration of that reef. And when we sampled the water, one of the most prominent chemicals out of our assessment was the chemical oxybenzone. And at the time, oxybenzone was in almost every sunscreen out there. It was the dominant UV protector in Banana Boat, Copper Tone, and everybody was using it. So we found that oxybenzone and sunscreen pollution all over the world, in places such as Palau, Hawaii, Mexico, Belize, Spain, Israel, Persian Gulf. So it's all over the place. And it's not on every single coral reef in the world, but it's on coral reefs where people go. It's on coral reefs that's important for tourism. And the sunscreen pollution is a symptom of unmanaged or unsustainable tourism. And that's one of the big take-home lessons out of this whole topic is tourism is what starts it, and tourism can fix it, meaning that sustainable tourism can be implemented and people can enjoy these coral reefs. They can participate in these reefs and in these natural resources if they do certain precautionary measures.
Such as?
So there are at least three things that we can think of as a precautionary measure. You need to protect yourself from the sun. So public health is critical. You need to protect yourself from UV radiation. But oxybenzone sunscreen, which is one of the most dangerous of the chemicals in sunscreen pollution, doesn't have to be a part of that solution. It doesn't have to be a part of that problem. So the first thing we recommend is to cover up. If you're going to be out on the reef and you're going to be swimming, wear a sun shirt. It doesn't have to be a tight rash guard. There are a whole bunch of companies out there, Mott 50, Land's End, J. Crew, that sell looser fitting shirts than surfer rash guards that you can wear in the water and then, you know, go up to the beach with it and go up to the cafe or the cabana and wear it on you and not have to lose the protection against the UV radiation, as well as being able to reduce your sunscreen pollution load by 50%. If you're wearing a sun shirt that has sleeves, that means you're not putting sunscreen lotion on your body in that area. That 50% reduction or more is a big conservation deal. It's a major conservation tool. The second thing you can do is to wear sunscreens that don't contain some of these more toxic chemicals, such as oxybenzone, actinisate, or contain preservatives like butylparaben or propylparaben or methylparaben. The parabens are actually endocrine disruptors. And many invertebrates use methylparaben as a pheromone. So the presence of these parabens are pretty bad. They're endocrine disruptors. And they can cause a loss of populations from prohibiting the development of a number of invertebrates in that area. Invertebrates like shrimp, like sea urchins, Christmas tree worms, there are about 1,000 more organisms on any given coral reef, especially invertebrate organisms, than just coral. Sea urchins are a big deal. Sea stars are a big deal. Feather worms, sea cucumbers, crabs, shrimp.
The whole ecosystem there.
The whole ecosystem, especially the invertebrates, are susceptible to these chemicals. So wearing sunscreen lotions that don't contain these chemicals, again, is a big conservation tool in mitigating that pollution.
When I first heard about Hawaii banning sunscreens, and I want to dive into that in a second, my first reaction was, well, how can just a small amount of lotion that we may slather onto our bodies affect a coral reef, which is can be many, many thousands of square feet and has the ocean tides coming in and out? And when you think of the volume of water versus the amount of even the most pernicious sunscreen, it seems like a small amount. But you and your team have come across some interesting data that shows that even these relatively small amounts matter quite a bit, don't they?
Yes. And so It's a really good question, and there's a number of perspectives associated with that question. First of all, you don't put on a little bit of sunscreen to protect yourself. That's actually a clinical problem called sunscreen abuse. An average person wearing a bikini or normal size swim trunks, they need to put on about 36 grams of sunscreen every hour and a half and then reapply. And so if you're putting 36 grams of sunscreen in your normal size person and you're getting in the water and you're in the water for 4 hours, you know, you're looking at about 72 grams of sunscreen. That's just you. Now multiply that by 500 to 1,000 people getting into the water in that day, every single day. It adds up. And oxybenzone is a persistent organopollutant. It will hang around from 90 days to 2.5 years. It doesn't break down.
And the tides don't wash it away, huh?
Well, not really. I mean, you got something called retention. And especially if you're in a bay or lagoon, that water is kept in that place. That's where the coral reefs are, and that's where people want to swim.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a offshore coral reef, seeing lots of heavy current and a lot of waves, you're not going to get a lot of people swimming there. And the coral reefs that see a lot of people are these fringing reefs. Fringing reefs are reefs that surround the coastline, that are on the coastline, and they can get up right to the beach.
Craig, maybe you can tell our listeners some ways that they might be able to take action to help the cause of banning these harmful sunscreen ingredients.
One of the easiest ways they can get involved is they can go to change.org. And we have a citizen's petition to the Food and Drug Administration asking the FDA to re-review the safety of oxybenzone and actinosate. And if we can get 1,500 signatures from U.S. citizens, what we're hoping to do is to provide that petition to a congresswoman or a senator and to personally then give that petition over to Commissioner Gottlieb of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to let the FDA know that we're serious, that the American people don't want to be poisoned anymore unnecessarily. And it's not just the, you know, people are being exposed not just from cosmetic products. It's in our food. All that sunscreen, all that oxybenzone is getting in the fish that we eat. It's getting into the plants that we eat. It's getting into the water we drink. So it's now a universal environmental contaminant, and we really need to do something about it.
Craig Downs is the executive director of the Hereticus Environmental Laboratory. Craig, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Cal Jader and Lee Dorsey.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.